Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church. On the web at ignatius.com.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, Tim Drake talks with Jules Green. She is a former abortion business worker who has not only left the abortion industry, but has also come into the Catholic Church. In the second half, Tim talks with Register correspondent Jim Graves about California's Carmelite Sisters of the Most Sacred Heart and their new efforts to assist the elderly. Thank you and welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Tim Drake, senior writer for the Register. Hello again, Tim.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
You know, a number of people have left the abortion industry, some in a very high-profile way, Tim. I'm thinking here of, you know, people like Abby Johnson, who has even written a book about her experience. Do we have any idea of exactly how many people have walked away from this rather deadly profession?
Yeah, it's a good question, Tom. You know, the organization 40 Days for Life has been keeping count, and they're aware of at least 69 abortion workers who have left the industry just in the last 5 years. And among them are Jules Green. She's a former abortion business worker, and she not only left the abortion industry, but she's become an outspoken advocate for life, and she also has entered the Catholic Church. Her story generated many readers online at the National Catholic Register's website, and so we decided to have her on Register Radio. Thanks for joining us, Jules.
My pleasure.
So, Jules, first of all, you know, I think the natural question is, you know, can you tell us a little bit about how you first got involved in working in the abortion industry?
Sure. I can tell you it's a strange journey. I was coerced into having an abortion when I was 17 that I did not want, and it devastated me. I tried to take my own life within weeks of my abortion, overwhelmed with guilt, but strangely enough, while I was recovering in an adolescent psychiatric unit for a month, I started to become a pro-abortion activist. I can only assume now, in hindsight, that I was trying to reconcile my guilt and thought, well, if it's legal and all these people think it's okay, maybe I can start to think it's okay too and stop torturing myself with guilt. And within weeks of getting out of the hospital, I marched for abortion rights in Washington. I volunteered as an escort at an abortion clinic and then was hired. This is all within just a few months of trying to take my own life after my own abortion.
And the natural other question that comes to me is, do you think that that some of these experiences are typical of those who work in the abortion industry? And in particular, I'm wondering what the percentage might be of post-abortive women who are working in the abortion industry?
Well, that's a very good point. I think it's pretty high. I know that when I worked at the center, I knew of many co-workers who were post-abortive themselves. Now, I don't know that they particularly went through the the scenario that I just described. I think my case might be a little more peculiar to me, but even in the folks who've come out of the industry, become pro-life, and have started speaking out, I'm not the only one who has also divulged that she's post-abortive. Abby Johnson, Catherine Adair in Boston, who's also a Catholic post-abortive former Planned Parenthood worker. So I think that's indicative of the fact that there's probably a high percentage of post-abortive women working in the abortion industry today.
Sure. And when can you tell us a little bit about when and how the transformation took place, how you became pro-life and started speaking out on this?
I think I've always been intuitively pro-life, which is why I was against the scheduled abortion for myself, for my baby. And I actually ran out of the clinic the first day it was scheduled and ended up going back 2 days later and then missed my baby terribly. And even the whole time I worked at the clinic, I thought what I did was wrong, but it should be okay for you to do it. It never really clicked for me until I guess almost 2 years ago, I was contemplating the bizarre, unnatural process of in vitro fertilization and gestational surrogacy, where a woman carries a child she is not genetically related to for another couple. And I learned of one of these gestational surrogates who, part of her contract was to have genetic testing on the baby she was carrying for this couple, and the test came back positive for Down syndrome, and she was paid her entire contract fee to abort. And that's when something finally clicked for me, that this is wrong. Pregnancy is not a commodity. Babies are not to be part of a transaction, to be bought, sold, killed, and discarded. And that's when I finally woke up.
And you didn't start speaking out immediately after that realization. It took you some time, right?
Well, actually, within a few weeks of being able to self-identify as pro-life, I stumbled upon Abby Johnson's book, and I wrote to her, and she and I corresponded, and I started volunteering in the pro-life movement, but I didn't start speaking until about a year ago. My testimony was published online last July on what would have been my baby's 23rd birthday. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I actually asked them to do that, to do it on my original due date, so that was really important for me.
Sure. I'm Tim Drake. You are listening to Register Radio, and we are speaking with Jules Green, a former abortion worker who not only left the abortion industry but also entered the Catholic Church. And that's what I want to ask you about, Jules, is the Catholic Church, of course, is one of the few that defends life from womb to tomb. And so I'm wondering, was it that, or was it something else that led you to consider the Catholic Church?
Most definitely, it was the Catholic Church's unwavering stand on the sanctity of life from natural conception to natural death. That was certainly a big draw, as well as in the Catholic Church, truth is not decided by popular vote. Truth has been truth since the Church was founded by Jesus Christ, and it's the same truth now. And part of that truth I found most appealing was the real presence of our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament. And that has got to be Eucharistic adoration, receiving our Lord in Holy Communion. That has got to be one of the most beautiful and awe-inspiring mysteries of the Catholic Church, and I'm so happy to be a part of it now.
Tell us a little bit about coming into the Church and how that came about.
Well, my husband is a lifelong Catholic. He has an uncle who's a priest, and I was a lifelong Lutheran. And he decided that it was all right he wasn't very strong in his belief at the time. So our children were baptized Lutheran. We went to the Lutheran church. And when I found out I was pro-life, I met with my Lutheran pastor and was very dissatisfied when I left that meeting, understanding that the Lutheran church has essentially a pro-choice, pro-abortion position. And the first book I read when I started to think about the Catholic Church was Rome Sweet Home by the Hahns, by Scott and Kimberly Hahn. And once I read that book, I called, you know, my husband's uncle, I called Uncle Bug, Father Bob, and spoke to him for about an hour, learning more about the Catholic Church, thinking about it. I started attending Mass. I started reading more conversion stories, more and more books. And then I started RCIA last September, and I was just confirmed this year at Easter Vigil, April 7th.
Wow. Well, welcome to the church. It's
Thank you. We're
glad to have you as a part of it. Can you tell me, for those who might be listening and might be working in the abortion industry, are there resources out there for them that can help them in trying to get out of the abortion industry?
Well, first and foremost, I would say, you know, once you stop believing the lies and the euphemisms that happen inside a clinic, like it's never a fetus or a baby, it's products of conception or the fetus or not even the fetus, it's your pregnancy, the pregnancy. Once those lies are lifted, sometimes it is hard to get out, and Abby Johnson has actually started a ministry called And Then There Were None, meaning if there's no clinic workers, there won't be any abortions. And that ministry seeks to help folks who have a change of heart while still working in the clinic. Because sometimes it can be hard to leave. Certainly in this economy, there could be financial reasons that keep, say, a family breadwinner working in an industry that they now find, you know, abhorrent and morally bankrupt. But there are also social reasons that are hard to leave the industry. All of your friends work at the clinic. When I worked at the clinic, all of my friends were pro-abortion. For years afterwards, all of my friends were pro-abortion. And Abby's ministry is actually helping with that, too. They're hooking up people like myself who've left the industry to just be social support and prayer support for women and men who are attempting to leave the industry. And I think both of those sides of the coin are important, the financial and also the social and spiritual end.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, and maybe you just answered that, but what the biggest obstacle is that prevents abortion workers from leaving the industry. And I wondered if it was fear or the financial aspect. If you had to point to one particular thing, what would you say it would be?
I would say that it's deception. And here's why. Abby Johnson's story is so unique in that she had literally an aha moment where one day it was okay, and the next day she had to watch an abortion on guided ultrasound, and that was it. She had a change of heart. For many of the other former clinic workers I've spoken to, it didn't happen until years later, and I think it's because the veil of lies is so very thick. And as I mentioned before, it's the euphemisms that surround the culture of death that make it psychologically acceptable. And it can take some time. And I think that one of the obstacles also for people leaving can have been, at least in the past, what they see when they look out the door. I worked at a clinic in a time when pro-life protesters outside of the clinic were not open and welcoming and peaceful and prayerful the way they are nowadays. The 40 Days for Life movement has changed more hearts and minds than just the pregnant mothers entering the clinic. They absolutely are to be credited with changing hearts and minds of folks working inside as well. If you know you're going to walk out to open arms, acceptance, prayer, support, and not judgment and scorn, it's going to make it easier to walk away.
Wow, this has been a terrific interview, and I just want to thank you, Jules, for taking the time to be with us on Register Radio, and God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tim. God bless you, too.
Oh, and my thanks as well, Jules. Your story is very, very powerful. When we return, we're going to talk about where we are all heading, God willing. It's not that bad. It's old age. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us.
Hello, I'm Michael Warsaw, Chief Executive of EWTN and publisher of the National Catholic Register. We're in a time in history like no other. In our fight for religious freedom and the need for the new evangelization, it's essential to stay connected via the faithful Catholic content delivered by the Register. We've finally been able to help realize Mother Angelica's dream. She always wanted a newspaper as part of EWTN's media apostolate. Why? Because there's an important catechetical opportunity at the intersection of faith and culture. Since the 1920s, the Register has been advancing the truth of the Magisterium. This valuable resource will help you to better understand the faith and deepen your relationship with our Lord. Join the growing ranks of Register subscribers today and access the one source of leading voices and opinions concerning the issues that matter most to you.
To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Tim Drake, I'm Tom Price. On September 8th, the Carmelite Sisters of the Most Sacred Heart opened the Rose Gardens at Santa Teresita. This is a new assisted living cottage for the elderly in Duarte, California. And the Register's Jim Graves has been covering this fascinating story for us, Tim.
That's right. This assisted living cottage is what the Carmelite Sisters hope will be the first of many, providing compassionate Catholic care for the elderly. Register correspondent Jim Graves reported on this development, and we decided to have Jim with us on Register Radio to tell us more about it. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what can you tell us about the first assisted living cottage to be opened by the Carmelites?
Well, its grand opening was on September the 8th, and it was kind of the product of many years of planning and reflection on the part of the sisters. And it represents their best effort to create a positive, healthy Catholic environment for seniors, in contrast with perhaps some retirement communities, which are viewed as, you know, in a negative light as a place for the elderly to go and to die. The sisters wanted to create a rich, positive environment for seniors where they could continue to have positive experiences and ultimately to prepare for their entry into the next life.
Sure. And I understand that the facility has some rather innovative features. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to say the location of the facility for your listeners is in Southern California. If they watch the Rose Bowl every year, it's about 20, 25-minute drive east in the facility. It's called Santa Teresita. And the idea is it's on a 12-acre site, and they're going to build 9 cottages, and each cottage has 2 floors. And each floor can house from 10 to 13 seniors. You get your own private room, or if you're a married couple, you can share a room. And once the facility is complete and they built it out, along with their other facilities, they're going to be able to serve about 314 seniors. Now, as far as the layout, if in the Register article there were some photographs of it. There is a central great room that the private rooms are around, and it has a central hearth and a sitting area, a dining area, and some areas for social activities. And it kind of a really nice feature is each cottage has its own kitchen rather than having the meals brought in from the outside, which the goal is to have the seniors help plan and even participate in preparing their meals. And once all the cottages are built, it's going to be brought together in a neighborhood, and they call it a neighborhood of care. And then the neighborhood itself will have some interesting features. It's going to have a post office, a soda shop, a pharmacy, a medical center where doctors can come in and see patients, and places that they can walk, trails they can walk on, and they even were talking about putting in a putting green. So it's going to be a lot of nice features there.
Yeah, almost like an old-time small town, if you will.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a real need for this as the population ages. There is an authentic need for this kind of compassionate care, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, as your listeners know, either perhaps helping their own parents or grandparents with health issues, as we age, our bodily functions begin to decline. We don't see or hear as well, or we don't walk as well, and we have any number of aches and pains. Certainly, we all need love, and we all need a place to belong. And when we're aging and we're experiencing weakness, we experience this feeling quite acutely, and we're all going to be there. It's just a matter of time. And also, as some of your other programs have indicated, our society, in many parts of it, human life is not respected, and that's certainly true with the abortion issue, which you were discussing, and also with the discussion of active euthanasia being legalized in our society. With this thinking, it's just a matter of time when the elderly and the sick are viewed as a burden, as consuming valuable resources, as people who ought to do the rest of us a favor and terminate their lives, which is certainly very much in contrast to Catholic thinking. I think what the sisters are doing is really important. It's a wonderful expression of our Catholic faith, telling the elderly and the sick that their lives are of value, that they're loved, and that their presence is appreciated. And not only is it true with the sisters, but they also welcome volunteers to come in and participate. They have an adopt-a-grandparent program where members of the community can come in and spend time with seniors who don't have any family.
Oh, that's great. And do you have any statistics at your fingertips, Jim, in terms of that just demonstrate the numbers of those who are aging and entering this period of life?
You mean at the home or in general in society?
I just mean in generally.
Oh, well, I don't have the numbers specifically, but certainly the population is graying, we're living longer, medical science is improving, and certainly there's going to be a much greater need as the years go on, and we've seen it not just in our society, but in other societies as well.
Yeah, and if I recall from your article, I think there was a projection that by the year 2050, 1 in 5 Americans will be 65 or older, and that if residency ratios remain unchanged, the number of people residing in facilities like this will actually double or triple by 2030. So it's quite an increase.
Absolutely.
You are listening to Register Radio. I am Tim Drake, and we are speaking with Jim Graves, Register correspondent. We're talking with him about the Carmelite Sisters and their assisted living center in California. Jim, what can you tell us about the Carmelite Sisters themselves? Was elder care their primary charism when they first started, or is this something that developed later?
Well, it developed a little later. The Sisters were founded in 1921 in Mexico. Their founder is affectionately named Mother Luisita. And for your listeners who saw the For Greater Glory movie, they were affected by the persecution of the church in Mexico, so they fled to the U.S. and they settled in Southern California. Their mother house is in Alhambra, which is right next to Pasadena. And in 1930, it's hard for us to believe it today, but tuberculosis was quite a threat to many people. So they founded a sanitarium for women with the disease in 1930. And they named it Santa Teresita because perhaps the most famous Carmelite of all is St. Teresa of Lisieux. And she died of tuberculosis right at the end of the 19th century. So they opened their mother house in Santa Teresita, and I've been going up there a number of times. They're a wonderful Orthodox community. They wear the full habit. They have traditional devotions, and they actually have retreats, primarily for women, but they do have some men's retreats, and I myself went on one. I don't know if you know Father Brian Milady. I think he writes for the Register.
Oh, sure. Yes.
He's a Dominican. He was our retreat leader, and he just did a wonderful job. So the orthodoxy in delivering the faith in an orthodox manner is certainly very important to them. So anyway, they founded the home for patients with TB, and then it ultimately became a hospital in 1955, and it worked for a number of decades quite well. But by 2004, the nature of healthcare had changed, and there were cost problems with the hospital, so they transitioned it into a home for the elderly. And the Santa Teresita site, which used to be the hospital, it's being torn down and it's being converted into these cottages, and the seniors are transitioning. So originally it was, as I say, it started as a home for people with TB and became the elder care facility it is today.
And I did find that aspect of the history interesting, that they were founded in Mexico and fled during the Catholic persecution in Mexico. Of course, just on the heels of the For Greater Glory film, I think it's timely to talk a little bit about that. But that was their key reason for coming to California, correct?
That's correct. Mexico didn't realize all it was losing when it was persecuting the church.
Yeah, and as I understand, they were not the only ones who came here. The persecution there was responsible for the initial, Mexican immigration to the U.S. So you're right. They didn't realize what they were losing.
Oh, there's one more thing I should mention. Now that the first home is open and complete, it's kind of focus is turning on to the second home, and the sisters mm-hmm. need to raise $5 million to build this facility. They're very much open to supporters to contribute. And also, if people who lived in the Southern California area were interested in residency, they should certainly contact the sisters and find out what they can do.
So with the first cottage, they are able to house how many seniors?
Well, let's see. It would be 10 to 13 per floor, and there's two floors. So we're talking 20-some seniors, depending on how many are in each floor.
Yeah, I can imagine that would fill rather quickly. What are the sisters' hopes, then, for the facility? How large in total do they expect it to grow?
Well, as I say, it's a 12-acre site. It's right at the base of the San Gabriel Mountains, and it's looking like they have room for 9 of these cottages. And then the sisters also run some other, couple other facilities for the elderly. So when they're all done, they're serving about 314 senior citizens.
In doing the research for your article, did you run across any other religious communities that are doing anything that's really very similar?
Not in this part of the country. Not in this part of the country. I mean, I'm certainly there are other parts of the country that very well may be true, but this was kind of unique in Southern California, which is where I'm based. I live about an hour drive from where the sisters are, so I thought that was really neat.
Well, Jim, I just want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today on Register Radio. It's fascinating to hear the stories of the Carmelite sisters and the very important work that they are doing, and we just thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jim, do you have a website that our listeners can go to if they want to know more about the sisters and of course, how to help them out?
Yes, www.santa-teresita.org, and it's T-E-R-E-S-I-T-A.org, and just click on the links and it'll take you to contact information for the sisters.
All right, thank you so much. And don't forget, you can listen to our show again if you'd like by going to ncregister.com. Be sure to look for that picture of the microphone, and you can click on that, listen to it, or download the show whenever you wish. Thanks again for joining us on Register Radio. For Tim Drake and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church. On the web at ignatius.com.